depending on the botanical origin of the feedstock that you're working with, fiber is not fiber, meaning the structure that you therefore need to open, if you're interested in opening up this fiber fraction, you need to make sure that whatever enzyme you're working with matches the biological origin of the feedstock that you're working with.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Hi-D from DSM Firmenich can improve your pig's vitamin D status. Hi-D offers pure, proven performance to help your pigs thrive.
AB Vista, new nutritional perspectives and novel enzyme applications to drive pig production. AccuFast, the best way to predict the future is to create it. Start creating your future today at AccuFastSwine.com. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. Healthy Farms by Bioverse, your manure management experts.
Biosecurity, take the right steps to keep your pigs healthy. Learn more at porkcheckoff.org.
Well, hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Swine It Podcast. I'm your host, Trey Kellner, and I'm excited because today I'm joined by Dr. Ruud Zijlstra, a professor in the nutritional food and nutritional science department at the University of Alberta. Good morning, Ruud. How are you?
I'm good, Trey. How are you?
I'm good. I'm doing good. We were just talking about the fall weather before we started recording. Being in, north of where I'm at, our good days, our good weather is getting shorter and shorter as we get to the cold months of the winter. So we have to enjoy days like today, don't we?
Absolutely.
Perfect. Well, hey, Ruud, why don't you introduce yourself to our audience, your background and your current role?
Sure. My name is Ruud Zijlstra. I'm originally from the Netherlands. In the 92 to 96, I did a PhD at the University of Illinois. Then moved to Canada and worked for 8 years at Prairie Swine Center in Saskatoon. And since late 04, I'm here at the University of Alberta, where I do mostly swine nutrition research, but also get into carbohydrates, so starch and fiber nutrition research across a slightly wider array of species.
Yeah. Now, thanks for that introduction. So we could talk about a lot of different topics. In fact, we could probably have a podcast series. But today, we're going to try to focus our discussion on non-starch polysaccharide enzymes. So, Ruud, before we get into the nitty-gritty and get to, that high-level, detail, let's kind of set up our audience a bit. First of all, what's an enzyme, right? The pig has, endogenous enzymes that are natural. We add enzymes to the feed. What's an enzyme and what's kind of the history of adding feed enzymes into swine diets?
Sure. So a pig naturally, as you kind of highlighted, has some capacity to deal with some of the plant-based structure with its own enzymes. And that's particularly true for starch, for fat, and for protein, but not for fiber. So, and also not for phytate, which is how phosphorus is bound in plant-based ingredients.
Sunai is a professional solution provider for enzymes, probiotics, and functional additives. We offer customized formulas to target nutritional issues in livestock and maximize the utility of animal feed. Find us at sunai.com, spelled S-U-N-H-Y, for more information.
So, for example, the stomach, pancreas, and the wall of the small intestine are all involved in protein digestion. Mostly the pancreas and the wall of the small intestine, they can degrade starch that then can be absorbed as glucose. On the fat side, we have lipase and bile, of course, coming from the liver and some other intricacies in order to get particularly long-chain fatty acids across the gut wall into the lymph. But for fiber and phytate, such mechanisms do not exist in the pig. In other words, the pig can does not produce its own endogenous enzymes to degrade fiber and the molecule phytate. So then the next part of the question is, of course, what has been done history-wise with potentially add those missing enzymes to a swine diet? So the history where, at least in my mind, just started a little bit, is when I was still living in the Netherlands in like the late 80s, early 90s. It was certainly described very well that there was a phosphorus excretion problem in the Netherlands that should, first of all, be characterized. So then phosphorus requirement and phosphorus digestibility were properly characterized. And one of those individuals was, his name was Arie Jongbloed, who then, let's say in the mid-80s, characterized what were now the limitations in digesting phosphorus in the pig. So that's where the molecule phytate was properly characterized, because each phytate molecule kind of bounds six phosphorus molecules. And so that phosphorus cannot be digested by the pig. So the pig, that phytase basically passes through the pig and gets excreted in the manure. And if that manure is then not managed properly, you can potentially end up with phosphorus pollution in the environment. So that basically then started a cascade of research in, first of all, characterize the missing enzyme, which is phytase. That phytase was then studied in an array of research starting in like the late 80s, but particularly in the 90s, in the Netherlands, in Europe, also here in the United States and North America. And people really started to figure out how much of this phytase would then benefit opening up this plant-based phosphorus and thereby reduce the amount of inorganic phosphorus, like dicalcium phosphate, for example, that we had to add to the diet until then in order to meet the phosphorus requirements of the pig. So this was a very unique scenario, a very successful scenario, where by basically adding one enzyme to the diet, you could open up this this phytate molecule, reduce the amount of inorganic phosphorus that had to be added to the diet. So basically also looking at feed cost. No, if the phytase was not too expensive, you could also work it into hopefully managing feed costs. But the big one, particularly for a government like the Dutch government, was controlling phosphorus excretion. So this scenario kind of hit the green button on a lot of items, marketing, feed costs, environmental considerations. And of course, then slightly later, of course, people on the research side, on the government side, on the industry side, and also on the pork industry side started looking, well, might there be some other limitations where supplemental enzymes can play a role? So I would say within 10 years after phytase was launched, certainly in Western Europe, a lot of research started to happen with fiber degrading enzymes as well, trying to mimic the success experience using supplemental phytase in swine diets.
Yeah. Thanks for that background. It's amazing, you know, how common phytase usage is. In fact, before this podcast, I was looking, I don't have a single diet without phytase today, you know, rooted. It's so common. So as we kind of, you know, something like phytase that we've added for maybe, you know, the past 30 years, common in swine diets, now focusing a little bit on NSP enzymes. So first of all, there's a couple different NSP enzymes. So give kind of a breakdown of each one and what they're targeting, and then we'll kind of go into the use and the mode of action of each.
Yep. Of course, I run the risk of forgetting one or two. But sure. But basically, what is important to understand that fiber across the different feedstuffs that we're working with is not exactly the same. So I live here in Western Canada, so I'll give you a little bit of the Western Canadian perspective. For example, when we feed finisher pigs, we may use barley. Well, barley, for example, is particularly rich in beta-glucans within its fiber fraction. When you do then look at wheat or corn, for that matter, you can have arabinoxylans that make up the bulk of the fiber. But even those arabinoxylans might not have exactly the same structure between wheat and corn. And then the list goes on. So depending on the botanical origin of the feedstuff that you're working with, fiber is not fiber, meaning the structure that you therefore need to open, if you're interested in opening up this fiber fraction, you need to make sure that whatever enzyme you're working with matches the biological origin of the feedstuff that you're working with. So, for example, there's not a lot of success that I can promise when you add a beta-glucanase to wheat. But if you add a xylanase, perhaps there might be an opportunity to improve fiber degradation.
Yeah. Yeah. An enzyme must have a substrate for it to work, right?
And in particular, that substrate should also be the first limiting factor for nutrient digestibility. Right? So that's also important to keep in mind that you can add like a more detailed enzyme that might break some bonds that you might be interested in. But if those bonds are not the first limit for example, for opening up the energy part of the diet, you may still not see an effect.
Mm-hmm. Why risk it? Your herd may have antigenic gaps that are not being covered by the products currently available. Custom-made vaccines provide a unique advantage in that they can be formulated to a herd's specific bacterial and viral needs. Choose the exact isolates, adjuvant, packaging, and size you need with Vaccinova for a vaccine formulated to your needs. Find out more by visiting us at vaccinova.us.com. That's vaccinova.us.com.
Now, so from a practical perspective then, Rude, as we kind of talked about, hey, you have to match up, you know, kind of your enzyme concentration and which one you use compared to what ingredients you have within that diet. So go into maybe a little bit more specific on how NSP enzymes can then extract value and nutrients from those raw ingredients.
So I'll describe two scenarios, one kind of on cereal grains, like intact grains that we grind and add to a swine diet, and another one where we can talk about, for example, co-products. So when you look at cereal grains, if you have high-quality cereal grain, that generally means there's less fiber there, okay? Meaning it has a greater energy value compared to the total pool of batches of cereal grains that might be out there. In that scenario, you will likely have, there's less chance of success for an enzyme to provide a benefit. So when you then look at the spectrum of ingredient quality within an ingredient, the greatest chance of success is with the lower quality feedstuffs. And of course, when you then look at the bigger picture, we particularly in the animal industry, we should regard ourselves as converters of using our livestock of less desirable food ingredients and turn those back into high-quality animal products that people can eat. And so I would predict the highest quality corn, the highest quality wheat, the highest quality barley. We should become experienced with those might not be the ingredients we see in the feed industry anymore because they're too valuable for either the food or the biofuel industry. And that means as an animal industry, we need to wrap our head around, well, we might be working more with lower quality ingredients, generally more fiber in those ingredients. And that's where enzymes can fiber degrading enzymes may then have a role to play. So that's one scenario. The lower the quality of the cereal grains that you're working with, of course, purchase those for a lower price. Okay? But then you also may have some flexibility economically in your swine diet formulation to perhaps add an enzyme as a risk management tool. So whatever negative effect this lower quality grain may have, for example, on feed intake, perhaps the enzyme may overcome that limitation. So that's one scenario. The other scenario is that over time, likely less cereal grain to begin with will be available to support our livestock industry because more of those grains are converted into, for example, on the cereal grains into biofuels. Right? And of course, what we've experienced for the last 20 years or so, particularly here in North America, is an explosion of the biofuel industry. And then, of course, on the cereal grain side, starch is being converted into ethanol. And on the oilseed side, the oil is being converted, for example, in biodiesel or renewable diesel. Then we end up with a lot of co-products from those industries. And those co-products also tend to be enriched in fiber. Right? They also tend to be enriched in protein. But that protein might not have the nice digestibility that the cereal grain protein may have. There might be some additional limitations on protein digestibility as well. So that might be another scenario where enzymes could play a role in managing that reduction of fiber degradation. And of course, the fiber in itself could be a valuable energy source, but fiber also hampers the digestibility of any other nutrient that is there in the diet, particularly protein.
Yeah. So we talked about, you know, how enzymes can increase digestibility of both quality ingredients and less quality ingredients. One thing I want to ask you, Ruud, and kind of pick your brain on selfishly, is then are there any further benefits past just, you know, greater digestibility? We hear conversations about, you know, enzyme breaking down fiber to provide, you know, gut health benefits, you know, better feeding the microflora, et cetera. What's your experience and what's your opinion on that type of strategy to provide further benefit and further return on investments?
There might be two sides of the coin here. Certainly, when you turn long chain fiber, right, the longest chain fiber, the likelihood that bacteria can work on that fiber, particularly in the upper gut, is likely remote. Right? So if you then have a fiber-degrading enzyme that chops those longer chain fibers into shorter chain fibers, there's certainly some evidence out there that that chopped fiber, if you will, may have a similar effect as adding a prebiotic ingredient to the diet. Because what a prebiotic is are oligosaccharides, as an example, so shorter chain fibers to begin with. Yeah? So there's certainly some evidence that that could be the case. There's another side of that, and that some of the fibers that we have in the ingredients, I mentioned beta-glucans, made by nature also have already a stimulatory effect on gut health. So under those scenarios, when you now add a fiber-degrading enzyme, you may potentially lose some of the benefits that fiber may provide directly on gut health. So my message will be very sure on what kind of fiber that you're working with and how that would benefit or not gut health if that is your target interest for adding an enzyme to the diet.
I appreciate the perspective. So within this area, Ruud, in your research, in your laboratory, what are you currently working on? And what do you think we have to learn about NSP enzymes to be more effective users of those tools and technologies, say, over the next 2 to 5 years?
My particular research program is a little bit now more focused on the co-product side.
Sure.
And we've kind of, you know, having in mind that if we just expect the pork industry to be less dependent on cereal grains, more co-products will be added to the diet. So then how can we then use enzymes as a vehicle to more successful feed diets that are enriched in co-products and support pig production that way? So that is my target research program at this moment. And then you can look at an array of different feedstuffs. And is it really, I would say, we're not even looking if phytase has an effect or not. We know phytase has an effect. So that is kind of the baseline for enzyme supplementation in our research. But then we may look at adding a fiber-degrading enzyme and a protein-degrading enzyme, which we call a protease, to see how they... these enzymes may then help with opening up the fiber and protein matrix in order to extract more value from those co-products. Of course, a side benefit is, could you potentially then have a similar positive effect on reducing or changing nitrogen excretion, nitrogen coming from protein, as what we have observed, of course, with phytase and phosphorus excretion. So that is one focus area that we're working on right now. Another one that I'm very interested in is so the co-product scenario is particularly valuable for feeding, growing, finishing pigs. Okay? So pigs from kind of feeding phase 3, maybe if you have a phase 4 diet in the nursery, all the way up to slaughter weight. There's another scenario where a lot of research investment has happened, and that is targeting animals with high nutritional demand. So in pig production, that means particularly nursery pigs. Mm-hmm. And the scenario that has been used there is, as opposed to solely just adding an enzyme to the pig feed, change the ingredient before you feed it to the pig using all kinds of feed technologies. So you can think of extrusion, but enzymes can play a role here as well. And for example, converting soybean meal in like a very highly digestible protein ingredient. Fermentation can be another technology that you can think of, which is, again, using enzymes to break open up the matrix in order to create highly digestible ingredients before we even feed it to a pig. So both those scenarios, I think there is an important role that enzymes can play, but how they're actually being used is very different. One is we add it to the feed and we let the enzymes do its work within the pig. The other one is we actually let the enzyme do the work before we even feed it to the pig.
Yeah, very cool. No, great, great areas to focus on for sure. Dr. Zylstra, what's your perspective on, do we need to analyze the ingredient and break it down further and characterize it better as well? We've been talking about TDF for maybe two decades, and people have thrown out, analyzing even down to the individual sugars. Do you think that component of this equation is meaningful, impactful, or what's kind of your perspective on are there learnings there, or can we characterize our ingredients better to then better select which enzymes we're using?
Great question. So there's two parts to this. One of them is fully understanding whatever biological material that you're dealing with. So, for example, if you have a canola meal sample, it's fully understanding how is the fiber matrix built up, because you may want to have a target enzyme that you're working with. But that detailed analysis, once it has been characterized properly on some canola meal samples, it's not needed to do that for all canola meal that is being fed to pigs in North America. For that purpose, basically to describe what is now the range in fiber in the batches of ingredients that you're working with, one or the other total fiber analysis may work with that, so that you know, is the ingredient that a batch that I'm working with in the middle or at the high end or at the low end of the fiber. And of course, when we then look at how we then actually make our diets, there's generally not a lot of time there too. So one tool that we should work on as well is NAR or other calibrations to rapidly predict what is the fiber content. Then using the biological analysis, we can then link it to fully understanding what is it now more or less of the matrix here that may perhaps then make adding an enzyme to the diet more attractive.
Awesome. Thanks for those insights.
It's time for our famous three.
Meet AccuFast, your trusted partner in raising efficient, healthy, and sustainable pork. We're not just about genetics, we're about tailored solutions that set you on your path to success, no matter how you define it. At AccuFast, we channel our investments into three crucial pillars: our genetic offering, proprietary technology platform, and leading commercial measurement system, ensuring tangible results for our partners. Visit our website at AccuFastSwine.com or reach out to an AccuFast customer success rep to discuss how we can help you create the future you've been working towards. AccuFast, the best way to predict the future is to create it.
I want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Fortiva, creating ingredients for impact to support animal resilience and health. Learn more at FortivaImpact.com.
MetaFarms, transforming agriculture with data-driven solutions for pork producers. SUNY, we provide value-added biotech solutions. Vaxinova, formulate to your needs, custom-made vaccines. Visit us at vaxinova.us.com for more info. That's vaxinova.us.com. Trow Nutrition North America, everything we do is driven by passion and backed by science.
I like to conclude our podcast with kind of four fun questions so our audience can better get to know you. They often, see you at conferences from time to time and might have a presentation for 30 to 40 minutes. So I want them to get to know you just a little bit better, so then there's better hallway conversations or can reach out to you as a better resource. So the first question I have for you, Ruud, is what's the biggest hurdle in your career that you overcame that you're the proudest of?
Interesting question. Well, I'm not sure if I've ever had really, really big hurdles. It's kind of, my career is kind of a mix of running into the correct people and making use of opportunities that were provided. So one example would be, as I mentioned, in the early 90s, I was still in the Netherlands. At that stage, there were very limited opportunities to do a PhD degree program in the Netherlands. And so I had an opportunity via an internship to see what was going on at the University of Illinois. And then I moved back to the Netherlands for a year, worked in the feed industry, and then I thought maybe I should follow up and do a PhD degree at Illinois. And that kind of opened up an array of opportunities for being involved in swine research here in North America. So if I wouldn't have responded to a single advertisement of going and pick up this internship, who knows where I would work right now. Or what job would I do? And so it's a combination of having some luck, running into the right people, and grab an opportunity when an opportunity is there.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. Yeah, it's amazing how one conversation or one mention or recommendation can set the rest of your career and life up.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So winter is upon us. In being in Canada, north of where I am, do you have a favorite part about winter that you enjoy here as we're going to get colder?
Well, I live here in Edmonton, in Alberta. And before I lived in Saskatoon, which is about a five-hour drive roughly east of here. So the big difference between the two cities is that in Saskatoon, I was working outside of the city, whereas here in Edmonton, I'm working inside the city, and that means instead of driving the car wherever I go to work, now I'm on my bicycle to go to work year-round. And that just gives a slightly different way of living. And so my favorite part is that most days I'm now outside, and that doesn't mean I enjoy being outside for 4 hours when it's, let's say, minus 20 Celsius. But at least being outside for 15 or 25 minutes twice a day, I find that very, very useful.
Oh, that's awesome. Do you have a favorite pork recipe?
Probably pork that is barbecued properly, meaning not too long, would probably be my favorite pork dish. And I need to say that certainly more and more restaurants, they're getting better in cooking pork properly.
Yeah.
And that is very important because overcooked pork, I don't think anybody likes that.
No, definitely not. And I agree. I think the experiences over the past 4 to 5 years at the restaurant setting have been much improved. So kudos for our pork boards and, those checkoff and extension outreaches for continuing to educate. I definitely think that's moving the needle for us. So.
And price-wise, it's a great product.
Yes, it is. Yep. All right. So last question here, Rud. If you had 1 minute to talk to a new faculty member, what advice would you provide him or her?
So new faculty members, basically a couple of components is in our particular university, there's a teaching role, there's a research role, and there's an admin role or service role. And that's how our faculty positions in Canada are built up. And so for teaching, it would be really take teaching seriously and enjoy being in the classroom. And that enjoyment will shine back to the students, and students really appreciate having a teacher in front of them that enjoys teaching. And then whatever opportunity you have for the research to shine within your teaching, students really appreciate that as well. So that you show the connection between what happens in the classroom to making further progress on the research side. Students really like those examples. So that might be some things to consider.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for your time today. It was a great discussion. This concludes this episode of the Swinet Podcast. We come out with episodes every Tuesday on your favorite places to watch podcasts and on YouTube. So with that, thank you, Rud, for joining us, and we hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.